Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Well, we're turning our attention to a book that's just been out. It came out in 2024 in October. And it's written by a Wisconsin guy, and it's written about Wisconsin in a lot of ways. It's titled When the Smoke Clears, story, and the subtitle, Stories and Reflections of a Wisconsin Forest Ranger. I finished reading it last weekend, and I really enjoyed it. And I'm pretty sure you will enjoy it, too, and enjoy hearing what Blair Anderson has to say about it. He's the author of the book. Blair spent many of his 30 years as a state forest ranger in the Spring Green area. And his book is really a reflections on his 30 years of work as a forest ranger, and again, a lot of it in the Spring Green area. And I hope you'll join in as we move along today. I learned quite a bit about the fire situation in Wisconsin. I learned about, I learned some great stories. He's got some great stories in the book about his own experiences and some things that I think you're going to find interesting too. You can join that conversation. Maybe you have a question about our Wisconsin fires. How are they different from those out in California, for example? He can tell you that. Or maybe you've got questions about fires that have occurred here. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. And Blair Anderson, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Larry. I appreciate the opportunity to be here with you and talk about this a little bit.
Oh, man. It was really fun for me to read. You had a decades-long career as a forest ranger with the DNR. It was funny, interesting to me that your working life started in the corporate world.
It did. I grew up in Chicago and ended up working for a Fortune 500 company for about 4 years. And being a child of the 60s, I was idealistic, just like everybody else, and decided I wanted to mix business with resources. So I came to Madison and got a forestry degree here. And then 1980, the job market was not so good, so I took a test and got an interview for the state forestry job, and they offered me a job, and I thought, well, it's something to do until a real job comes along. 31 years later, I'm ready to write a book.
You suggest in your book that many people have kind of romantic or unrealistic ideas about what a forest ranger does.
I think that's true, yeah. I think sometimes people get this image of a tower, you know, out in the middle of no place on top of a mountain, 40 miles from the nearest civilization, and a lone person that goes out and saves the world for Smokey and has little else going on, just a life totally committed to nothing else but the resource out there. And that's a good romantic notion, but it's not very realistic.
I remember, I think when my first year on the job, I had to go to northern Wisconsin to cover another thing, and I saw one of the fire towers.
Yes.
You know what? I'm going to climb up that tower and interview the guy that's in that tower. And I took about 5 steps up that tower, and I realized, no. I climbed right back down. Yep. I didn't go all the way up there.
Yeah.
Well, you didn't spend any time in it, well, maybe not much time, of any time in a tower.
No, never did. The towers were in most of the areas that we protected for longer, starting in the 20s. In the southern part of the state, we started protection later, and we didn't use towers. I had some old DNR friends that said, oh, you need to put some of the tower stories in your book. And I understand there are quite a few very good ones, but They were not ones I was involved in, and I wanted to stick to stuff that I knew.
Well, and you wrote that forestry was perhaps the best respected element of the DNR, because forester, you know, they're most helpful and minimally involved in regulations.
Yeah. Usually when we get, you know, when we get involved in fire, sometimes there's some legal entanglements, but the forestry side of it, which was also a very big part of my job in Spring Green, involves helping people, you know, write plans for their forests. It's a very long-term thing, probably the longest-term activity that people plan in their lives, because you're looking out, you know, 100 years or so in a forest, and we help them with that. We helped them with tree planting. We had some cost-sharing programs that we could offer to help them do the stuff that they wanted and needed to do anyway. So we kind of came alongside and were helpful that way, and I think we were appreciated a little bit because of that.
Yeah. Well, I can't tell you how many times, many, many times over the years, I told people from one area of the state or another, when they had a question relating to this, you ought to see your DNR, give us your DNR forester a call.
Yeah.
They'll come out.
Yep. Yes, they will. They'll come out and they'll see what's going on. And there was a good connection between not just our forestry people, but like if you had a property and you had a stream going through it, we could get a fisheries person involved. Most of the county forestry people were connected with, you know, federal resources like, you know, the SCS and so forth. So they were able to bring other, you know, whatever other resources were needed to bear on a given situation. So it was really a pretty helpful thing, and not regulatory for the most part.
You know, one of the things that surprised me a lot was the number of fires. We're talking about your area, that Spring Green area, that the number of fires at certain times of the year. I mean, you mentioned once that you, mentioned it in passing, that you'd already, it was 12 or 14 fires for that day.
Yep. Yeah.
And you were on to another one.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, 12 to 14, I never read about this.
Yeah. Well, a lot of them are pretty small.
Yeah.
Our Easter weekend was always, that was usually in early April. And down here in this part of, in the southern part of the state, that was when we were really starting to seriously dry out if we weren't getting rains. That was the time. And so we, you know, when that time of year came, I'd just say goodbye at home and say, I'll see you when I see you, because, you know, as long as the sun was shining, we were working.
Yeah. So the and when I say working, you were working. I mean, you had your own equipment and could do it.
Yes.
But you worked in tangent with many other local fire departments, for example.
Yes. Yeah, very much so. The areas down in the south were geographically larger than they were and than they are in some of the hotter areas in the, like the pine areas in the state and the central sands and northwest. So I actually had, I think, 20 or 22 different fire departments that I worked with, you know, depending on where a fire might be. So it was a lot of good opportunity to connect with those folks, and a lot of differences in fire departments.
I see, yeah. You say they come in a lot of sizes.
Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah. And some of them are better funded than others, and some of them are in, you know, smaller towns where, you know, a lot of the jobs have left town, and so there aren't a lot of people around during the daytime, and it's kind of a challenge for them. But, you know, one of the really nice things about my job, I thought, was the fire community. I mean, everybody that you work with, you know, other rangers, occasionally up in the north we'd work with federal fire folks, but certainly the fire departments, they were so committed and enthusiastic about doing fire management work, whether, like, for the fire departments, whether it was structural, which they were better trained in, or wildland, which we were better trained in, and there was just a lot of mutual work and a lot of mutual respect that was involved in that, and that just made it apart from all the hard work of fighting fires, it was just a very pleasant work environment to be involved in.
I was at a meeting once in Cottage Grove, Wisconsin, and in the middle of the meeting, there were a lot of people there. Suddenly, there was a tone went off, and about 10 guys jumped up and ran for the door.
Yep. Yeah.
And they just literally jumped up and ran.
Yes.
And that was a volunteer, Cottage Grove Volunteer Fire Department.
Yep. Yeah.
And these guys are volunteers.
Yes, they're volunteers. When I came to Spring Green, keep in mind I grew up in Chicago, when I came to Spring Green, it was my first introduction to this whole concept of a volunteer fire department, and I was just flabbergasted at the amount of time and energy and commitment that people in the community were willing to commit to be prepared for fire situations, for the EMS people to be prepared for trained and ready for those kinds of situations, and all on a volunteer basis, just as kind of a reflection of how neighbors take care of neighbors in a bigger sense. And it was so different from anything I'd seen before, and it was really attractive to me, and I very much enjoyed kind of getting involved in the community.
Yeah, and you write a really nice, you have so many great stories, but I thought you wrote a very insightful discussion about community and what a community like that, how it operates.
Yes. Yeah. It's fascinating, and it intrigued me, and I really took note of a lot of different things about it, and I tried to include some of those in the book. I've got a friend that grew up on a farm and went to the ag school here, and it's only in the last few years it occurred to me to ask him what he majored in. He's running a mission effort in Guatemala now, but I asked him, what did you major in when you went to ag school? And he said, rural sociology.
Yeah.
And I'd never thought of that as a discipline. But, boy, having spent the time I spent in Spring Green, I can sure see it. I sure understand it. It's different.
Well, I had a lot of courses in rural sociology as an undergraduate.
Well, good. Yeah, it's fascinating.
That's what really fascinated me about it. Jeff in Berry Mills has something. Let's go there. Hi, Jeff.
Yeah, I couldn't resist this call. Last week was Patterson Park, and now this week it's the fire tower. When I was on that work detail for the youth conservation camp back in about 1968, a ranger came into camp this morning looking for a volunteer. Found out I volunteered for what he was doing. I got to go paint a ranger tower that day, leaning out the windows with a brush on an extension. Painting it silver while he was on the roof painting it gold.
Oh my!
Yeah. Oh man!
That's. I'm glad you were able to do that because I couldn't. By the time I got to the 10th step on the ladder going up the tower, I would have been freaking out from the height. So thank you very much for what you did.
Jeff, thanks a lot for calling. Oh, man. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you can email us to talk@wpr.org. Talking with Blair Anderson. He authored the book, When the Smoke Clears, Stories and Reflections of a Wisconsin Forest Ranger. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here talking today with Blair Anderson. He's written a dandy book. It's titled When the Smoke Clears, Stories and Reflections of a Wisconsin Forest Ranger. And you'll learn a lot about forest rangers and about fires here in the state and a lot about what goes into being a forest ranger. And Blair certainly has lots of experiences to share in his book. So join in. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1234, email to talk at WPR.org. Matthew emailed to ask, what was the most common cause of fires you responded to? Like debris burning, railroads? Yeah.
Well, that's an easy one. Almost all the fires that we have in Wisconsin are caused one way or another by people, which is not necessarily the same as it is elsewhere. But most often it was a result of people deliberately burning something, a burning barrel or a brush pile or a bunch of seed bags or whatever, and it gets away. That was probably the cause of, at least debris burning was the cause of at least half of the fires that we had.
And you talk about structure, and you've already mentioned this, structure fires, wildland fires. And they're fought in the different ways, are they not?
Yeah, they're very different. And most simplistically, with a structure fire, you have a high fuel load in a fixed place, and you kind of come to it and set up around it and put it out. With a wildland fire, you have much lighter fuels, and they're scattered, and so the fire is moving. And so there's a unlike a structural fire, there's a premium placed on being mobile, and so we have vehicles like our small fire vehicles or 4x4s, they can get around in rougher country than a big tanker or a pumper from a fire department. And we have crawler tractors that we use to put in plow lines around fires that can work through woods.
Yeah, and when if you got a wildland fire, you don't necessarily have you can't drive right up to it.
No, and sometimes you don't want to. If they're that hot, there are safety concerns that are you have to keep in mind constantly, and they're always changing because the fire's changing, the fire's moving. Maybe it's getting into some new fuels, and there are other considerations. Maybe there's a house ahead of it, and you have to make a specific plan related to protecting the house or trying to steer the fire around the house so that you don't have problem with that kind of exposures. Yeah. All kinds of things going on. It's very stimulating.
I was thinking about myself. I had an experience when I was a young guy. I was helping one of the local farmers, and he was burning some marsh.
Yep.
And he started a backfire, and so he had there were the two fires, and I was going to run across between the two because my buddy was over on the other side, and I started, and then I don't know. It was going kind of slow, but then suddenly it just took off, and I'd have been halfway across.
Yep. You were wise to restrain yourself.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Things can change very quickly. Winds can come up, winds can shift. There was always a time of day, late morning, early afternoon, when you could just see, like if we were doing a prescribed burn, it would be creeping along, and you could just sense how the relative humidity was dropping, and the way the fire burned just took on a whole different nature. It just got more ferocious, and you realized, we got to get this thing wrapped up here because the weather's changing, and the afternoon breezes are starting to kick in, and we don't want this to get too exciting.
Yeah, you told one. I don't know. It wasn't humorous. It was in a way, but it wasn't. You were with a TV reporter had wanted to be come out.
Yes. Yeah. They're always more humorous in retrospect than they are at the time. Yeah, this was a gal that was with one of the TV stations in town here, and we were doing a prescribed burn, and she was really quite interested in it, and things just got going a little bit faster, and I was trying to walk her out to a place where we would be safe, where we would be out of the range of the fire, and I couldn't get her to move, and We had
well, she had heels on. She was kind of dressed up.
Oh, she was dressed to the nines. Yeah, she looked great, but not the kind of thing that you necessarily want to wear out to a burn.
Yeah,
and so. Yeah, that was, I won't go any further. You got to read about it. It was interesting, though.
Needless to say, she wound up in some water.
Yes, she did. And the report that she filed included only video of the fire. It did not include her. She was a mess by the end of the fire.
Oh, man. Mike in Oregon, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hey, fellas. Hey, Larry. Yeah, I've got a firefighter story for you. We were up north at our cottage, and the whole backside is national forest. And mm-hmm. I had a little antique boat I was putting into the shoreline, and there some of your guys were there with their SUVs and whatever with the lights blaring. And they said, hey, could you give us a hand? And I said, sure, what do you need? He says, well, could you use your boat to go to the other side of the lake where it's national forest and pick up one of our guys? I said, sure, you know, so I went over there, and this poor guy was on foot with all of his fire gear on, you know, that thick jacket and the pants and everything. It was about 90 degrees out.
Oh.
And when he came on his way back, he ended up in the middle of the lake and needed a way back instead of going around the whole thing. And he must have brought 10,000 mosquitoes with him. You could barely breathe with all the mosquitoes everywhere. And I just felt so sorry for that guy running on foot to try and get to this fire because there's no way for the ATVs to get there.
Yep. Yeah, access can be an issue in some of the northern areas we have in Wisconsin and the UP, that can get you into low areas that are just, like you say, you can hardly help but breathe the mosquitoes. When you've been through some of that, by the time you get to the fire and it's a little hotter and drier and the mosquitoes are driven away, it's almost a relief.
Mike, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. It reminded me of another story in your book, and this one has some real practical applicability to anybody listening right now, and that was, I might have been early in your career, there was a fire, I think it was a marsh, or at least a marsh-like area. It was burning, but the way the wind was, the smoke was only kind of like up to your knees.
Yes, that was fairly, I know what you're talking about. That was a very late spring fire. In fact, we had kind of thought that we were done with fire season. Our fire season generally, it kind of begins to kick off when the snow melts, and it mostly comes to an end when things start to green up. And so things had, with this particular fire, things had greened up, and we were kind of starting to stand down a little bit. We were having very few fires, and it's funny how it just almost turns off. It's like a switch is thrown at the end of spring. But we got called out to a fire northeast of Spring Green, and I went out. I was at work, and I ended up kind of going out right in tandem with the Spring Green Fire Department. And we got out there, and it was a little fire walking up a hillside adjacent to an ag field. We couldn't even see flames. There were like 3 feet of vegetation there, and most of the fire energy was being expended evaporating the moisture in the plants. So we got in there and quite easily put the fire out. And as the story tells, a few days later I noticed my leg itched a little bit, and as the day went on and the next day came, it turned into a rash. And what I realized was that this fire had been burning through poison ivy, and that the oil, the urushiol in the poison ivy had vaporized and had gotten on my legs. And I, as much as my legs itched, I was thankful that the smoke hadn't risen enough that I had breathed it and gotten it into my lungs. But my legs were pretty miserable for quite a few days after that.
Yeah, and that reminded me, I mean, you know, there are people out there who have some poison ivy on some property and they may want to burn it. Don't be breathing that smoke in.
No, and that's not a real effective way to deal with poison ivy. And you know, if something gets away, then somebody's got to go out there and get in that smoke, and you know, with all the stuff that's in it.
Yeah.
So,
you investigated the cause of a lot of fires.
Yes.
What did you look for? I thought that was a whole interesting part to look at that you did, to look at how determine the cause of the fire.
Yeah. Well, the first thing you have to do is figure out where the fire started. Frequently, I would say most of the time, that's fairly obvious. You know, if you have a V-shaped fire with a burning barrel at the base of the V, you know, I could, even in my first year, I could figure that out. but sometimes it's not so clear. And so you have to figure out where the fire started. And there are a number of different burning indicators, how the fire burns, how soot deposits on trees or on rocks, or how grass burns or lays over. There are all kinds of different ways that you can read a scene and determine what direction the fire was burning at a particular point. And when you get to a point where it's pretty unclear what direction it was burning, you're probably real close to the origin. And once you've sort of identified the origin, then you start looking around for something that might have caused it. I mean, you know, maybe there's a brush pile there. One time I found the residue of some fireworks. And so that, you know, so then you go to the next step of the investigation and ask around, hey, was anybody shooting off fireworks? Oh, yeah, the neighbor down the road was out here. And you kind of put two and two together and figure it out.
And what happens, I mean, you have many stories. Sometimes that can involve fines or sometimes you kind of use your judgment.
Yes. Yeah. One of the things an old sage law enforcement officer told me early on was the objective of law enforcement is compliance. You know, we're not trying to punish people. We're trying to get people to do the right thing. And so, you know, if we had a situation where somebody burned something that they shouldn't have, or burned it at the wrong time, or did something foolish, if I became convinced that they really didn't know what they were doing, then usually I just tried to give them a little 15-cent education and a warning and called it good at that. Sometimes I'd run into the same people repeatedly, and it was apparent they knew what was right and wrong. They just needed more motivation to do the right thing, and I was happy to provide that.
Oh, yeah, there's a few interesting stories in your book about a guy you gave a warning to, and then like a week later.
Yes, yes, it was 2 days later.
2 days?
2 days, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I couldn't believe it.
He said he'd never do it again.
Well, I hope not.
Yeah. Well, he said he'd never do it again, and then 2 days later, he did it again.
Yeah. Well, the second time, I gave him more motivation to not do it again than I did the first time.
You know, another thing that I think people should think about with their own property or with their own work, and you write about this, is when you guys fight a fire and finish the fire, all right, the fire's out, but there's a mop-up.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's something I think everybody needs to think about.
Yes. Yeah. Mop-up is mop-up is the unglamorous part of forest fire control. You know, when the flames are screaming, it's, you know, you can sort of shout bonsai and charge in and work at it. It's exciting and you get your blood up. But when the flames are knocked down... And the fire is what we would term contained or controlled, you still have to make sure that there's nothing in the fire area, or at least around the perimeter of the fire, that's going to have an opportunity to blow out maybe soon or the next day and start the fire up again. So there's a lot of just... It's just hard, back-breaking, dirty work, working around the edge of the fire, oftentimes with a with a backhand and 50 pounds full, and digging up those spots and putting them out. And it's not fun. And, you know, people, when the fire gets knocked down, people like to kind of separate from the scene because they know what's coming next. And the ones that stick around and say, yeah, I'll help you with that, those are the ones you really appreciate.
Yeah.
But you got to do that well. And I had any ranger that works for a long period of time is going to have a fire that's been contained get away from them. And I had a couple too, and those are painful lessons, but you learn from them and you don't make those mistakes again.
You said the one thing you didn't want to have is that you put out a fire and then later that night or the next day, the fire's going again.
Yeah, the fire's going again, and the fire department gets called out, and these volunteers, these are not people that are getting paid to do a job like I am, they're volunteers, and they're pulled away from home or pulled away from dinner or pulled away from work, and they know that they're there because I didn't do my job well.
Yeah.
I didn't make sure that fire was adequately suppressed and mopped up, and when you're out there with them, yeah, they're very gracious about it. But as the ranger, you know, you feel it. I was kind of self-condemning more than they were. But but you learn to go to extreme measures to avoid that happening again, because these are the people that you work with, and you respect them, and they do good work, and you want to treat that offering, that volunteer effort, well and seriously, and not take advantage of it.
That mop-up reminded me of some fires that are really hard to clean up, and those are peat marsh fires.
Yeah.
There was one you wrote about that took place, I think it was around Middleton, Wisconsin. Was it Middleton or was it Verona? I've forgotten.
No, it was further east. It was, I think it was close to Watertown. I remember it was in the township of Lebanon. I don't know if that's Jefferson County. I don't remember, but the town itself didn't have a fire department, but there was a fire department that we worked with. And, you know, peat fires, peat soils, if you will, you know, which is like peat moss. You go to the garden store and buy a bag of peat moss. This is the kind of stuff that we're dealing with, and it burns, but it smolders more than it burns. And so there aren't open flames that you can see. There's just smoke, but those fires will, you know, peat moss can be, if it's really dry, is quite resistant to water. And the same is true out on a fire. And to get to a spot that may have burned 6 inches or 2 feet down into the peat, you have to get out there and dig it up and get right down to it and put water on it to get it out. And so the fire that I tell about in the book, I think we were there for 8 or 9 days going out. First thing in the morning, you go out at first light, because that was the only time there was no wind and you could see the little wisps of smoke. And we'd mark them with a very advanced material that we acquired called toilet paper.
And
we marked it with that, and then the rest of the day was spent, you know, going to that toilet paper and digging up and finding that hot spot and dumping water on it. And we did that for 9 days before we were satisfied that the fire was out.
Ron in La Crosse, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Ron.
Yes, I'm just calling, you know, hearing about, you know, preventing forest fires. And I know my brother back in 1965, I had one older brother, and he got a federally funded youth summer job program funded by federal government clearing brush in a local county park. And he and the other teenagers that worked that summer really enjoyed it. Don said he really enjoyed that. But as our government and the Johnson administration got more involved in Vietnam, you know, and spent more money there than in the domestic programs, they cut funding for the summer job program. Well, the upshot of that is 4 years after Don was clearing brush in the county park here, he was clearing brush again in Vietnam. We had a draft back then, you know.
Yeah. Those were challenging days.
Yeah, they were indeed. Ron, thanks for sharing that. Appreciate it. It reminded, I don't know why, but it reminds me of, you know, there aren't a lot of, I'm sure there are people injured pretty often here in one way or another during a fire. You might get a little burn, you might fall and break a leg or whatever. There was one state forester in 1982, Don Eisberner.
Yes, yeah.
You're right about him.
Yeah. That was pretty early. I started with the DNR in 1980, and I got to Spring Green in time for fire season in 81. And so I was pretty new. I was pretty green at this. And as I relate in the book, got a call one day at the end of the day, and you know, after some sort of chit chat, you know, my boss gently told me that a guy had been killed on a fire, and it was there were all sorts of reactions. One was just disbelief that this, you know, sort of, you know, fun, exciting, swashbuckling firefighting thing that I was doing. I mean, you knew there's a downside, but until it happens to one of your coworkers, you don't really appreciate it. And then to realize, you know, some of the details around what happened that resulted in his death was really sobering. And you could hear it in tones of voice on the radio, you know, the next day. Everybody was just kind of, oh, I don't know, they're just kind of tamped down. Their emotions were hit by this. That's the only firefighter we lost in the 30 years that I worked for DNR and fire. We other people died, but sometimes it was more medical stuff. There'd be people who'd have heart attacks like that. But this was strictly fire, and
led to some protocol changes.
Because of it. Yeah, he was operating a piece of equipment that was different from the one he usually used, and the controls worked backwards, and so when the fire came and he went on instinct, he moved the controls the wrong way and stalled out the unit and got burned over.
Yeah, and that led to protocols that everybody had to have the same operating.
Everything, all the hydraulics were plumbed the same. Yeah. And that was it's a expensive way to learn a lesson, but the lesson was learned and action was taken to prevent that kind of thing happening again.
So. Yeah. Oh, man. Talking today about the book, When the Smoke Clears, Stories and Reflections of a Wisconsin Forest Ranger. Blair Anderson is the author, and great to have him as our guest today. And you can join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. At WPR, we're committed to delivering high-quality programs from all over Wisconsin, and that's why we have news bureaus in your part of the state. Our local reporters keep us all connected, and you can support that essential service by joining in a special challenge. When 600 people donate before March 6th, a group of generous members will donate an extra $10,000 for WPR programs. You can give right now at WPR.org/donate. That's WPR.org/donate. Right now, we're talking with Blair Anderson about his book, When the Smoke Clears. Now, let's take some more calls. Karen in Madison, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Karen.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to say things that I heard in what you said. I'm curious about what you did before you became, you know, worked for a Fortune 500 company. I was touched by how in your job you learned so much about community connection and human beings. I and that people that work with nature, they tend to be aware of nature's web and that everything is connected. And also even the caller that called about his brother being in Vietnam, and our country decided to spend dollars on Vietnam rather than, you know, really making the world a better place. And the only other thing I wanted to say is I really heard in your conversation education and how it's important to have a broad education, because then we can see how everything is connected, like in your rural sociology. And, you know, and we, that's what the direction I believe that we need to take to really heal this planet, heal human beings. You know, our kids are very unwell from being so disconnected from the planet and so on. And also seeing the forked tongue with which adults speak. One is of greed, and one is, I'm hoping the other is, you know, be well, do good works, and so on.
Well, yeah, we're an interesting species, aren't we? A lot of different things. I would wholeheartedly agree with your comments about education. Young people, I think, sometimes get in their minds that there's a certain thing that they want to do, and you know, maybe that's a genuine calling, and they should pursue that. But as you observe, Karen, education broadens one's perspective and helps you appreciate not only the things that you see, but maybe even things that you weren't aware were there. Like my epiphany about rural community when I came to Spring Green. There's a lot there, and it's good counsel for young folks, I think, to keep open minds and open eyes and you know, look into all sorts of different things, because you never know what's gonna stimulate you and move you to doing something interesting. I worked in downtown Chicago for a Fortune 500 company for 4 years, and I enjoyed it, but I didn't know what I didn't know, and I was fortunate enough to follow this circuitous path that led to Spring Green and get exposed to all the stuff that was so stimulating to me and was made for such a satisfying work career.
You talk about, I really did like that, and you would really enjoy, ma'am, that whole section in Blair's book about what goes into a community. You talked about integrity was one of the things. And you say born not of regulation or competition, but of relationships and reputation.
Yes. Yeah. You know, we make rules, and you're supposed to follow the rules. And if you don't, a bad thing can happen to you. And maybe that's a good way to learn. But the thing that so struck me in Spring Green, and we talked a little bit here today about the whole volunteer thing, but the idea that people in small towns better, you see the same people at the store, at the grocery store, at the hardware store, you know, at school, in church, and there's a more tacit understanding of the interrelationship between people. And When people see that and understand that, it's a better motivator for them to so-called do the right thing, because that becomes a function of those all those interrelationships that you're involved in all aspects of your life with the same group of people in a small community like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a beautiful thing.
It is. Maya in Lone Rock, we'll go to you now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for having me. It's nice to hear Blair's voice. I commented that my husband read his book, and I am next in line to read it. I got to hear a bunch of the stories because my husband was excited about it when he was reading it. And I'm also going to comment the fact that what Blair was talking about being in a small town, Blair also was very instrumental in working in our local food pantry here, and his work has been a legacy for the rest of us that are still volunteering in that food pantry.
Oh, thank you for calling, Blair.
Yeah, thank you for your kind words. I appreciate that. I certainly spent a lot of time working with the folks from Lone Rock. You know, you're in that river bottom area where we have a lot of potential excitement with the pines and the pine lands there. And so it was a close community, part of our school district in River Valley and Spring Green. And so a lot of good connections there. I'm glad your husband enjoyed the stories, and I hope you enjoy them too when you get your turn at the book.
Yeah.
And thanks for your thoughts.
Yeah, thanks so much, Maya. And you eventually became an EMT for the neighborhood, for the community. You were elected to the school board.
Well, yeah, and that was part of a sort of a growing recognition. You know, we need to do things for each other, and I helped in the community, I suppose, through my professional work with the DNR, but that was a little different. That was my job, and I thought, well, you know, other people are doing this and that, and so I identified a couple of things to get involved in that I thought were ways that my background could help, and that was very encouraging to be able to do that and to kind of see how you help people.
Yeah. Carl in Barneveld, we'll go to you. Hi, Carl.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, and I just wanted to say another legacy that Blair left. He helped me with, I've got 40 acres of land here that was 40 acres basically of thistles, and we transformed it into a forest. I remember Blair coming out and telling me about his history when he was inspecting the little seedlings and how, as an accountant, everything was black and white, and with forestry, it's not the same.
Yeah.
Professionally, I worked with him at Blue Mountain State Park where we did an experimental seeding. Instead of planting trees at a tree planter, we broadcast acorns over an old field, and that is now a forest, too. So he's leaving a legacy of trees behind, too.
Well, good. Again, thank you for those kind words. It's a satisfying line of work to be involved in because there are a lot of positive success kinds of stories that come from them, as you mentioned. And one of the cool things is that, you know, those trees in that forest will be there long after I'm gone.
Yeah. Thank you, Carl.
Yeah, that was great.
And Lanny in Ashland. Hi, Lanny.
Hello. How are you guys?
Good.
Yeah. We're good.
Good. I just want to comment. I come from a big city, too. I live in Ashland, Wisconsin, which is way up north. I'm on Lake Superior Bay, actually. And I got a nice apartment here, but I'd like to just thank that gentleman there, the DNR guy, because I remember when I was growing up, we didn't really like the DNR because we got in a little trouble. But when you get older, you kind of respect that.
We talked about this kind of at the outset of the show. A lot of folks of the DNR are involved in regulation, and If you run afoul of that, and that's one of your first exposures to the DNR, you can take a not the most positive perspective on it.
Well, your book is so filled. We haven't even touched on all the stories in the book, and I hope a lot of people get a chance to read it, Blair. It's been a real pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much, and thanks for writing the book.
Well, thank you, Larry. I appreciate all the good news and good information that you share with the good people of Wisconsin here.
Yeah. Blair Anderson authored When the Smoke Clears, Stories and Reflections of a Wisconsin Forest Ranger. You'll learn a lot, and you'll have some good laughs, too, along the way when you read his book. It was a real pleasure for me to talk with him and to read the book. And a pleasure with our team as well. We got a good team for you. Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins, our technical directors, Clara Kniper, Joel Patnaud, our producers, Jill Nadeau, our executive producer. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store on WPR News.